Hare Krishna. Thank all of you for coming today evening. And yesterday we discussed about emotionally healthy spirituality, where I talked about how we don't work for our body or mind. We don't work against our body or mind. We work for Krishna with our body and mind. Just as we need to take care of our physical health so that we can focus on our spiritual health. Similarly, we need to take care of our emotional health. So if something pains us too much physically, we adjust so that the pain becomes minimum and we can focus on Krishna. Similarly, if something emotional disturbs us too much, then we adjust so that we can focus on Krishna. And when we are sharing Krishna Bhakti with others, preaching means we make the emotions conducive to the reception of Krishna. So preaching can mean comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comforted. And then I talk also towards the end about how we cannot use a one-size-fits-all formula for either sharing Krishna Bhakti with others or for applying to ourselves. Whatever a particular person's needs are, they need to be accommodated and then we can move forward towards Krishna. By the way, how many of you were there for yesterday's talk? Oh, yes, okay. It's a good number, we're not there. So today I'll speak on two main points about how we need to take responsibility for our spiritual advancement. And secondly, how we need to understand that there are different levels of causation for whatever happens and how we address things at different levels. So whenever any particular thing happens in our life, say if somebody falls sick and gets malaria, now when that person gets malaria, what is the cause of that? Because there was some bacteria which came through a mosquito. The mosquito must have bitten, that's why the person got malaria. That's true. But then in the same house, there might have been 5 people living and only one of them got malaria. Why is that? They say, this person had some low immunity, but somebody else might be having lower immunity, still they don't get the malaria. So there is the immediate cause, that is, the person got malaria because they were a mosquito bit them. But beyond the immediate cause, there is a remote cause. The remote cause is that all of us have done particular karmas in the past and the karmic reactions come upon us. So the mosquito bit, if I got malaria, the mosquito bit me at a time when I was particularly vulnerable and that's how I got the malaria. So it's my karmic reaction. And beyond that, the ultimate cause of all distress, of everything that happens for that matter in the world, is forgetfulness of Krishna. It is because we have forgotten Krishna, because we have become disconnected from Krishna, that's why we are trapped in the present world that we are in. And here we undergo various situations. So now, when we understand this triple level causation, then what do we address? The immediate, remote and ultimate cause. So we address it at various levels. So for example, if somebody is sick, if the person has got malaria, then at the immediate level, we try to take some treatment. Now, along with that, like we have Ayurveda, or we have allopathy, or we may have different kinds of medical treatments, which can work to address it at an immediate level. Along with that, we also understand that I have to ensure that I don't do further bad karma, because that reaction will come some way or the other. So we try to purify ourselves, which we stop doing bad karma. The karmic reactions will not come by that. And ultimately, we strive to remember Krishna. We try to become devoted to Krishna, by which we address the problem at an ultimate level. A lot of confusion results if we mix up the solutions at different levels. If we think the immediate solution is the ultimate solution, that is a big problem. Because the nature of the world is that some distress or the other will come. There's a prominent doctor, Leonard Boy, who wrote a book about 50 years ago about titled Health in the 21st Century. Health in the 21st Century, the future of an illusion. So his theme was, the whole book was how, although science has advanced a lot, and through the scientific advancement, we have cured many diseases from the past, but we have new diseases that have come up. Today we have brain degenerative diseases, we have cancer, and so his point was that diseases are not simply something which you can cure with medicines. Diseases are results of the socio-cultural situations that we live in. So the Black Plague was not eliminated simply because we discovered a vaccine. It's also because the nature of human civilization changed, and we're not so much exposed to rats, and rats also did not have so much facility to grow. So with our best medicines today, we don't have much cure for HIV, because today's socio-cultural, biocultural environment is such that HIV is very resilient. No matter what treatment we find, it comes up, it mutates in some other way. So if we work at only at the immediate level and think that the immediate solution is the only solution, then we get ourselves into trouble. We think that we are solving problems, but we are not solving problems. Most of modern science and technology work at the level of immediate solutions. And often the promise is, this is the ultimate solution. But it is not. So, on the other hand, sometimes we may work only at the level of ultimate solutions. And we may think that the ultimate solution is all that I need to do. And I don't work at the level of immediate solutions at all. Suppose I wake up in the morning and I chant Hare Krishna Mahamantra with full attention 64 rounds. Will that 64 rounds of chanting remove a bad breath from my mouth which comes when I wake up? But that's not why I chant the Hare Krishna Mahamantra. There's a toothpaste for that, there's toothbrush for that. I don't expect the Hare Krishna Mahamantra to do the work of a toothbrush. I'll have to brush my teeth and then I chant Hare Krishna. So Hare Krishna Mahamantra will deal with the problem at the ultimate level. So just as the immediate should not be made into the ultimate, similarly the ultimate should not be made into the immediate. The two are different levels of solutions, and both solutions have their place. When Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna, and thereafter Arjuna fought the Kurukshetra war and won the war. Now, did Arjuna win the war with the knowledge of the Bhagavad Gita? Or did he win the war with the knowledge of archery that he had learned from Drona and he had mastered throughout his life? Which knowledge was it? It is both. It was the knowledge of the Bhagavad Gita gave him the purpose of why to fight. It gave him the inspiration to persevere in his duty. But the practical skills of how to fight, he learned from his archery skills. The Bhagavad Gita is not there to teach him archery skills. So there is the immediate, there is the remote, and there is the ultimate. And if we mistake the immediate to be the ultimate, that can be as problematic as it is when the ultimate is mistaken to be the immediate. there are some extremist Christian organizations in America which say claim that if you just surrender to Jesus, if you have faith that Jesus is your savior, then by that faith and surrender, you will be freed from all sins. And if you are freed from all sins, means that you will become free from all problems. And the converse side of this is that if you are not freed from all problems, that means you are not really surrendered. That means you don't have enough faith. So for example, there are some people, some youth, this is a tragic real life story. So when this happened, they said that if you have some problems with the eyes, if you have some problem with the eyes because of which you need some glasses, then if you surrender to Jesus, your eyes will be healed. Jesus made the blind people see. So what to speak of somebody who has a little vision? They should be able to see. And they tell that you stop wearing glasses now. And these poor students, they're not able to read without glasses. Have faith, you'll be able to see. If they're not able to see, they told that, oh, that means you don't have faith. Have faith, you'll be able to see. Now, this problem became so serious that now the US government has passed a law that if any religious system of belief interferes with people's medical health, then that religious belief system can be outlawed. So now it's a valid governmental concern. If people can't see, if somebody is driving a car and they can't see what is next to them, say, have faith, you will see. That's ridiculous. So the immediate and the ultimate cannot be mixed up. The immediate solution works at one level, the ultimate solution works at another level. When we practice bhakti, Srila Prabhupada worked at various levels. Srila Prabhupada, he was transcendental, he was completely absorbed in Krishna. Still, he took care of his health. He worked extremely hard, sleeping for a few hours. But still, he took time out for a massage every day. He went for a morning walk almost every day. He consulted Ayurvedic doctors. He took treatment. And it was required. And then finally, when no immediate solution was working, at that time, he just took the ultimate solution. He stopped all treatment and he said, my only treatment is Harinam. He said, give me a little Charanamrit, and I'll hear the holy name. But throughout his life, that was not what he was relying on. He took the immediate also when it is required. So the immediate and the ultimate function at different levels. Somebody may say the immediate solution doesn't work. Ultimately, we may quote from scripture also that one solution leads to 10 other problems. That is true if we make the immediate solution as the only solution. Some devotees say that that if you have got a disease, you should not take painkillers. Because it's by your karma you are suffering the pain. So if you take a painkiller, you're trying to escape your karma, and then karma will come to you some other way. Well, okay. By that reasoning, you know, if you are hot, don't use a fan. Because when you are hot, what is happening? It's your karma coming to you. Why are you using a fan? Then don't. Why only come to a painkiller? You can stop all material comforts. No, what is one of a fan? Even if you are hot, now don't even remove sweat from your face. Why? Because that's your karma. Now, if a baby is crying, the mother should not pacify the baby. Why? Baby is suffering a karma. Now, if we start attributing every single problem to a remote cause or ultimate cause and don't work at the immediate level, now all systems of justice, all basic systems of culture and civilization, everything will stop. If somebody has been robbed and the robbed person goes to the king and says, oh king, I've been robbed. You robbed because of your past karma. Well, what somebody's past karma is not as important as what the king's present dharma is. The king's present dharma is to protect the citizens. So there is an immediate cause and there is an immediate effect. And if A has robbed B, then it is for the king to punish A and get the wealth back for B. So this is, it's not that in the name of looking at the ultimate, we don't look at the immediate. So we have to, if the immediate cause is addressable at the immediate level, it needs to be addressed. So as I said, the whole system of Ayurveda is looking at material cause and material solution. Okay, you got a disease, this is because the kapha vata pitta in your body has become imbalanced, and take this substance, take this medicine, it will get balanced. So addressing the immediate cause at an immediate level is one solution. It is not the ultimate solution, but it is one solution that is required. And there are times when the immediate solution, or when addressing the immediate cause, will not lead to a solution. Those who are doctors know, sometimes you see that this patient has got malaria and you give that patient treatment for malaria and still the patient doesn't get healed. Try, it doesn't happen. And then that means something else is going on over there. So when the immediate cause doesn't lead to the solution, addressing the immediate cause does not lead to the solution, we also look at some other remote cause. So for example, if say there is water spilled over here and I walk on the water and I slip and I fall and I get a sprain in my leg or my leg gets fractured. Now what is the cause of that? Now say that actually, you know, it was your past karma because of which you slipped. Okay, you can say that. There are three other people who walked by there, they didn't slip and fall. I only slipped and fall. So yes, it was my past karma because of which I slipped and fell. It's fine now. But does that mean that I should not clean the water from there? All those people whose past karma is there, only they will slip and fall. No, not like that. We have to address the immediate cause also. So we address the immediate cause, but it is not that if I have slipped and fallen, then I start getting angry with the person who spilled the water and I just went out at them. Okay, it's happened. We address it at that level, make sure that the water doesn't spill like that in future, or it is cleaning sooner enough. But there's no need to blame the other person as the sole cause of our problems. So when there is an immediate cause and there is an immediate effect, addressing it at that level is important. But there are situations when it will not get addressed at that immediate level. Some people, we can see that there are some people, they eat a little and they stay thin and healthy. Some people eat a lot and still they stay thin and healthy. Some people eat a little and still they become fat. So normally we could say that little food leads to, you eat moderately, you stay healthy. You eat excessively, you will become unhealthy. But some cases, some people eat a lot. They treat their tongue like a conveyor belt. And still they stay healthy. Some people eat a little and still they fall sick. Something goes wrong. So now what does this mean? There is a correlation between how much we eat and how our health stays. But some people, by their past karma, may be destined to have good health in this lifetime. Good health means an attractive physique, a slim physique. And then how they eat doesn't affect it so much. Some people, by their past karma, are meant to have a sickly body in this lifetime, or an attractive physique, or whatever. So whatever they do, it doesn't make much difference. So that means what? Our actions have consequences. The causes and effects are related. But the delay between cause and effect may be there and how much delay may be there, that may depend on the past karma that the person has done. So if somebody is eating unhealthily, that will have consequences. But it may not come immediately. So we look at the explanation for karma when we don't see the immediate cause and the immediate effect. Or rather, when we don't see the solution being addressed at the immediate level. If it works at the immediate level, fine. If I come and slap one of you, why did you slap me? I was giving you the result of your past karma. You can slap me back. I am giving you the result of your past karma. No. So, actually speaking, we all are meant to behave in a cultured way. And if there is some person is upset with me, I have to try to see why that person is upset with me. And if I have done something wrong. Sometimes, some people stay negatively disposed with us, irrespective of what we do. No matter how kind, how gentle, how kind, how considerate we are, still they are negatively disposed with us. Then, when there is no immediate cause and still there is a situation coming up, or there is a small immediate cause and there is a big situation coming up, then at that time we can understand, yes, this person is in this way disposed because there is some past karmic situation and this person is giving me the result of my past karma. So I can see it that way. So when the immediate cause and immediate effect, that correlation does not explain, then we look for something more. Now, why are we talking about this with respect to emotionally healthy spirituality? All this also applies to our emotional health. We need to address whatever issues we have at our level. Now, some people may be very sensitive. Speak one small word to them, they just get very disturbed. Some people, have a very thin skin. Small words hurt them. And some people, they are like a hippopotamus. Sometimes if a bike collides with a hippopotamus, the bike falls down. So, whatever you speak, nothing, there's no effect on them only sometimes. So, there are different people who are of different natures. And now, if somebody is a little more sensitive, then that means that that person has a particular situation. So, at one level, if somebody speaks harshly to them, then the people around them also have to become a little sensitive. You know, this person, I have to really watch my words, I have to watch my actions. But from their perspective, they have to understand, okay, I have a particular nature by my situation, and then I have to address my needs. So, we need to not get carried away by working only at the immediate level. At the same time, we can't reject the immediate level by saying that only the ultimate is the solution. So, to talk at the solution at the immediate and ultimate level, we can give the example of a pain-killing medicine and a curative medicine. Any solution at the immediate level is like a pain-killing medicine. Yes, so if it's hot, okay, I turn on a fan, I use the AC. That's a pain-killing medicine. Pain-killing medicine, what does it do? It offers temporary relief. So like that, we can say that if I have sickness, I take treatment, I become healthy. That's temporary relief. Because ultimately the body is going to grow old, get disease, and it's going to die. But it's the important thing is not that whether the relief is temporary or not. What am I doing with the temporary relief? So A, if the pain-killing medicine helps in taking the treatment, helps in living properly, if the pain-killing medicine is an aid to the curative medicine, then that is fine. If the pain-killing medicine becomes a substitute for the curative medicine, that's a big problem. So if the immediate solution is all that I work on, if I think that by scientific and technological progress, now we will solve all problems. There is a genre of thought which is nowadays coming up. It is called transhumanism. Transhumanism means they say that through the humanity faces the problems. What problems? We become old, we become sick, we die. Same Bhagavad Gita philosophy. But they say that by the advancement of science and technology, we will transcend our humanity. And we will conquer our old age, disease and death. So, again, the point here is, they are working at the immediate level to solve that permanently. But it's not going to work. So, if we make the immediate solution the ultimate solution, that is like making the painkiller as the curative medicine. That is harmful. But at the same time, if we take only the curative medicine and don't take the painkilling medicine, that may subject the patient to too much pain. And the patient may not be able to survive. So the painkilling medicine can act as a complement to the curative medicine. So similarly, for us, we need immediate solutions also. So if we look only for the immediate solution, you know, this person, I can't relate with this person properly. So I spend my whole energy trying to find a person with whom I can have a nice relationship. And that's all that I'm searching for. And even if I find such a person, how long am I going to live? How long is that person going to live? So we could say establishing a stable horizontal relationship is one level of solution. We have to work on developing our eternal relationship with Krishna also. Now the painkilling medicine and the curative medicine both need to work together. Here, make one more important point. That when doctors prescribe pain medicine, they don't always prescribe the same level of painkilling medicine for everyone. Because different patients have different tolerance levels. So, some person in the same disease, like if recently I broke one tooth of my tooth somehow while I was just eating some date, and then I went to a doctor, and the doctor looked at it and said, he says, I'm not feeling any pain. I said, no. He said, you know, you've got tooth broke, you should be crying in pain here. He says, it's not that I'm stoic or something. Then he told me that actually, with respect to pain, you cannot predict. Sometimes a person gets a fracture and they're crying in pain. Sometimes a person gets a fracture and they just go on with normal life. And then they go to a doctor and say, oh, I got a fracture over here. Oh, I didn't know. So, you know, the same damage to the body may be there, but the extent of pain that different people feel can be different. There is no necessary one-to-one correlation. Okay, your bone is dislocated by, say, 1 millimeter, therefore you will have this much magnitude of pain. Your bone is dislocated by this much, you will have this much magnitude of pain. So we cannot, in fact, pain cannot be quantified also that way. So the point which I am making is, different people may require different dosages of pain medicine. The important point is not how much pain medicine somebody is taking or how much pain medicine somebody is avoiding. The important thing is how much the person is taking the curative medicine. The curative medicine is what is going to cure. The pain medicine is meant to assist. So for us, when we are practicing bhakti, like some people, as I said, they may have a very thick skin. So they may not feel the needs of so much love, affection, attention. That means for them, they don't need much pain medicine. Some people may need a lot of love, affection, attention. That means they need a little more pain medicine. But the important thing is not how much pain medicine a person is taking. Or somebody who is very detached, you think, I am so spiritually advanced. Somebody else, they are so sentimental. Well, that's okay. That's the way where we are. We have to move from where we are towards Krishna. So, renunciation in the sense of, say, being able to tolerate worldly pains, being able to live without worldly pleasures, renunciation is a valuable resource on the spiritual path. So we could say painkiller, taking less dosage of painkiller, we can say that's something like having a high level of renunciation. You don't need much material comforts, you don't need much material pleasures. That's good. But you have to see, renunciation can be the result of various things. At one level, the Bhagavatam says that by the practice of bhakti, renunciation comes. Vasudeva Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojita Janayatya Ashu Vairagyam Jnanam Cheta Hetuka. And by the practice of bhakti, knowledge and renunciation come. But at the same time, there can be even people who are non-devotees who can be renounced. In the sense that they satisfy the simple living. You often hear of people who give up illustrious, prosperous software careers and just decide to go do some eco-friendly living. They go and start some eco-friendly farm and they're living in villages and they're taking care of things. They satisfy that simple life. In fact, one of the greatest paradoxes of the 20th century was that Hitler, who killed or was responsible for killing almost 12 million human beings, never killed a single animal for eating. He was a vegetarian. Now, he had that level of detachment, but he had so much ego, so much hunger for power that he killed so many human beings. So that there may be some people who may not be able to give up meat at all, but they will never even think of hurting another, hitting a human being, what to speak of killing a human being. So there is different karmic combinations that will come. So some people may have a certain level of renunciation by their past karma. Just like we see wealth, some people are born with very wealthy families, some people are born in not so wealthy families. Some people are born with great looks, some people are not born with mediocre looks. This is, we understand that Krishna has six opulences. So beauty and wealth, if somebody has more, somebody has less. We understand that is a result of past karma. Similarly, renunciation is also an opulence. And some people, by their past karma, may have more renunciation. Some people, by their past karma, may have less renunciation. So, now, renunciation can come in two ways. Renunciation can come by the practice of bhakti, but renunciation can also come by the past karma. Now, we always have to think and view things in a way that is favorable for our devotional service. Say some devotee is very renounced. We should minimize that. It is all by your past karma. You are not a sincere devotee. We shouldn't say like that. But the important thing is we have to see what approach works for us. So sometimes some devotee by their past karma may be very renounced. Now renunciation is a very valuable resource for practicing Krishna Bhakti. Just as wealth is a very valuable resource of practicing Krishna Bhakti. Somebody has a lot of wealth, then they can do so much service, they don't have to worry so much about money, and they, through the wealth, they get some influence in society, they can do a lot of things. But just as wealth can easily be abused, similarly, renunciation can also be abused. Somebody may use the renunciation, abuse the renunciation to become proud, and look, condemn everybody who is fallen. And then, that renunciation will not necessarily take them towards Krishna. See, our renunciation is meant to help us look undistractedly up towards Krishna. When we don't have much renunciation, what happens? We're looking at Krishna and we look at something attractive in the world. Oh, let me look at this also. 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 So we can't look undistractedly towards Krishna if we don't have adequate renunciation. But if I use my renunciation not to look up at Krishna but to look down at others, so fallen, so attached, such a sense gratifier, then my renunciation will not lead to my spiritual advancement. So I'm talking about this point of renunciation here to illustrate that different people may need different levels of material comforts, material facilities, so that they can be peaceful and they can practice the process of spiritual growth, practice bhakti. Just as while taking treatment, while taking the curative medicine, different patients may require different levels of pain killing medicines. So the person's health or person's commitment to the process of recovery is not to be judged only by how much painkilling medicine they are taking or they are avoiding. Now again, here also another complication comes, is that if a person is recovering, then also they will need less painkilling medicine. Just as if somebody becomes spiritually advanced, they may become more materially detached. But the point is, the essential treatment is not to be tested by how much one is avoiding the painkilling medicine. The essential treatment is how much one is taking the curative medicine. So we need to focus on connecting with Krishna. And for connecting with Krishna, if we are in a particular situation where we need some more painkilling medicine, then we take that. Now what do I mean by painkilling medicine? We can say broadly, some people have a more emotional nature, some people have a more rational nature. Now if somebody has a more emotional nature and they need more emotional bonding with other devotees so that they can practice bhakti peacefully, that's the painkiller they need. They take it and move onwards towards Krishna. Somebody has a more rational nature and they need answers to their questions. They need proper philosophical understanding. Then that's the painkilling medicine they need. And they need to get that and then they move towards Krishna. So, whatever be our present situation, we start from there and we move towards Krishna. And based on our present situation, we may have particular needs, which it is our responsibility to address. So, emotionally healthy spirituality means, what by emotion I am using it inclusively to talk about our mental needs or the needs of our subtle body. So whatever they may be, we need to provide for them. That's it. If I have a rational need, if I have emotional need, if I have an introvert nature, if I have an extrovert nature, whatever it is, I have to take care of that so that I can move towards Krishna. And if I don't take care of that, then I am not taking care of my emotional health adequately. And it's like I am not taking the appropriate painkilling medicine. Then I'll be in so much pain that the pain will make my life miserable. And sometimes what may happen is the curative medicine is working, but because the curative medicine is working, takes a good amount of time. And because this patient is not taking the painkilling medicine, so the patient may think, oh, this doctor's treatment only doesn't work. And the doctor gives up the treatment. And the patient gives up the treatment. Now all that was required was the appropriate dosage of the painkilling medicine so that the curative medicine will take its course and will heal. So most often, when devotees become discouraged in the practice of bhakti, or devotees leave the practice of bhakti, it's not so much because the process of bhakti has not transformed their lives. Bhakti does, the process, chanting Hare Krishna, remembering Krishna, does transform us. But sometimes because of the lack of the painkilling medicine, the pain may be so much, we may feel that what relief is bhakti providing? So if devotees become very, if somebody is very sick and that person is having fever and that person is in great distress, and somebody goes and tells them, Prabhu, you are not your body. This is the time for you to realize what you have been preaching all these years. Well, okay, I know I am not my body, but right now my body is suffering. And so I am suffering. Now, if somebody is in trouble, we cannot separate, say, I love your soul, but I don't care for your body. We cannot separate the person like that. I love your soul, but I don't care for your mind. No, the person right now is an integrated whole. And to care for a person means to care for their body, mind and soul combined together. We don't care so much for their body that we neglect their soul. We don't care so much for their mind that we neglect their soul. But we have to care for everything. So if a devotee is sick and devotee is suffering at the bodily level, we see that as an opportunity to do service to that devotee. To assist that devotee, we see that as a Vaishnava Seva. And by that we move closer to Krishna and that devotee moves closer to Krishna. Because that devotee gets the necessary support. So if there is physical pain and because of that physical pain, somehow that devotee is not able to practice bhakti or is too disturbed because of the physical pain, then addressing that physical pain is what is required so that they can practice bhakti peacefully. And if somehow that physical pain is not addressed, that doesn't mean the process of bhakti has stopped working. But what happens is that we feel, oh, I was practicing bhakti but still I got so many physical problems. and nobody cared for it. So what is the use of practicing bhakti? So what happened was, the pain killing medicine was not provided, and because of that we gave up the curative medicine also. That should not happen. So from the individual, so there is a, from the individual's perspective and there is a community's perspective. The individual should not think that, oh, because I did not get the painkiller, so I should stop the medicine. You know, I was in trouble and nobody came to help me. I was at a place and then there was one devotee came and said, actually I was sick, I was in the hospital and not a single devotee came and called me, nobody talked with me. I thought they will come and give prasad to me every day and nobody provided anything. And I asked the other devotees, they said that, this devotee never told us that I was sick. No, they should have known I was sick. How do you expect them to know? Are they Paramatma? So if we have a particular need, it's for me to communicate. You know, if some devotees come to know, okay, you're sick, then other devotees can support. If they need some help, they will provide. But if we have a particular need and that need is not provided for, and then we hold that against bhakti itself, nobody cares for it. Well, we are misunderstanding this. So from the individual's perspective, we have our social needs, we have our emotional needs, we have our physical needs, and ideally speaking, the devotee community should provide for them. But if they are not provided for, that will cause pain to us. And if that pain comes, we will need to address that pain. But just because that was not provided for, that does not mean the process of bhakti is not working. The process of bhakti is working at a curative level, but the pain-killing medicine is also required. So from the individual's perspective, if the pain-killing medicine is not provided, that doesn't mean that the devotee should stop taking the curative medicine. Still, okay, this is what has happened. Whatever reason, let me continue practicing bhakti, because that is the ultimate solution. But on the other hand, from the community's perspective, we should be there to provide whatever is needed. So even if it is something at a material, at a physical level, at an emotional level, support needs to be provided. So that the painkiller is provided, so that the medicine can be taken. So the mood, there is the individual and there is the community. So both are encouraged to work cooperatively. I'll give two examples for this, then I'll conclude, we can have questions after that. First example is, so let's consider old age. In the Bhagavatam, quite often it is talked about how when somebody becomes old, they renounce the world, they become sannyasis, they travel from place to place. And Prabhupada says that a sannyasi's characteristic is that they should be fearless, even if they are going in a forest. Sannyasi should think that Krishna is with me. And Prabhupada says in one purport that, hey, it's a sannyasi. So a renounced person dies alone in the forest with nobody coming to know whether that person is living or dying. That means that person has completely detached oneself from the world. And such a death, completely unknown to the world, that is a success. And Prabhupada talks about this in how Dhritarashtra dies alone in the forest. He talks about that in the purport over there. But on the other hand, while the individual is told, you take sannyas, become detached. But on the other side, in the Vedic culture, five categories of people are expected to be protected by society. Which are the five categories? The children, the women, the cows, the brahmanas, and the elderly. Now the elderly are to be protected by society. So on one side, the elderly are told, you renounce the world, go to the forest and die unknown. But the society as a whole is told, take care of the elderly. So here what is happening? That means at an individual level you are told that, okay, don't depend on the painkiller. Even if the painkiller is not there, just focus on taking the medicine and you get cured. But the community is told, provide the painkiller. Now support, give support to society. So in this way, there is cooperation. At an individual level, we try to develop more and more renunciation, we try to develop more and more absorption in Krishna. But at a social level, we try to provide whatever is required for a person's needs. So at an emotional level, when our emotional needs are not taken care of, then it is our responsibility to find out how to take care of those needs. We can't, at a community level, we should find, you know, the leader of the community observe, okay, and we find, okay, this person has this kind of need. We put this person with this person, they can get along together very nicely, because both of them have a similar nature. Put this person, yes, doesn't work. So that is what from the community side that can be done. But from an individual's perspective, it is my responsibility to make spiritual advancement. It is my responsibility to go towards Krishna. And if I need a particular painkiller so that I can practice bhakti, I can take the curative medicine of bhakti, then it is my responsibility to get the painkiller. Now where I get it, that's up to me. Where I get it means that it may not, if I am of a particular nature, then I have to find out who else is of that nature, and then I bond with them, and then I can move over towards Krishna. So different devotees have different definitions of success, and based on their definition of success, now definition of success, by what I mean by that is the ultimate success, of course, that we develop love for Krishna and attain Krishna. But while we are in the world, some devotees may say, oh, distribution of books, that is the most important thing. Some devotees may say that, oh, Harinam Sankirtan, that is the most important thing. Some devotees may say that, oh, you know, making a farm community, that is the most important thing. Some devotees may say, Vishadam distribution, that is the most important thing. Some devotees may say, building a temple, that is the most important thing. Now, all these are valid and valuable definitions of success. And, you know, in through every one of these definitions of success, we are actually serving Krishna. And no, the we all have to find out how best we can contribute to Krishna's mission. So every community will have the leaders, the visionaries, who will focus on a particular definition of success. And we can, as much as possible, try to harmonize with that vision, with that focus. At the same time, if we have certain needs, rather than demanding that the community provide for that, we work to provide that. So if I have a need to study Shastra very deeply, and I feel that, okay, the classes here, they're good, but they don't go deep enough. I would like to understand this, I'd like to understand this, I would like to understand this. There's no need to blame that this is not being provided. Some people have a more intellectual nature, they want to study more, they can pursue that. There's no need to blame others for not providing what are my specific needs. I take care of that and I move forward in my bhakti. So we contribute as much as possible in accordance with the community's definition of success. But if we have individual needs, we take care of those needs. So that way, both the individual and the community move forwards. So for us, Krishna concludes the Bhagavad Gita by telling Arjuna, Yathechchitta Guru. Now do as you desire. That's 18.63. But there are several verses which come before that. I'll quickly go through those verses. I'll stress the significance. Krishna, in 18.58, he states, Machiptaha sarva durgani mat prasada tarishasi atachvetta mahankara nashoshasi vinangshasi. He says, if you become conscious of me, you'll pass over all obstacles by my grace. If you don't become conscious, if you act out of ego, you'll be lost. So this is a broad, be Krishna conscious or you will be lost. That's what Krishna is saying. But how to be Krishna conscious? Then he talks about, he says, Swabhava jena kaunteya nibandha svena karmana kartum nechasyan mohan karishasya vasopitar idahankaram ashritya nayotsiti manyase mithyaisha vyavasayaste prakriti stvam yokshati. Krishna says, at Arjuna, if you think out of ego, you will not act as I am telling you. Then material nature will make you act. You are thinking that you will act brahmanically, you will forgive your opponents, be peaceful. But in the future, when you are provoked, the brahmana asks for charity. Brahmana's hands are like this. A kshatriya takes taxes. And when a brahmana tries to act like a brahmana, please give me some charity. Person say, I'll not give you charity. Then the Brahmana Kshatriya nature will come. I'll take it. So he says, at that time you will not have the authority to take because you are not a responsible king. In this way you will go into moha. So Krishna says, Swabhava jena kaunte nibandha svena karma. All of us will act according to our swabhava. Denying our swabhava is not going to work. Kartum nechasi and moha. You say, I don't want to act like this. Karishasya avasho pita. Still you will act in that way. Our nature, he says, you cannot give up your kshatriya nature. Then 18.61 he says that, okay, does that simply mean that whatever is my nature, I act according to my nature and do whatever I want? He says, no. Ishvara sarva bhutanam hriddeshe arjuna tishtati brahmayan sarva bhutani yantra rudhani mayaya. He says that Ishvara, the Supreme Lord, is present in our body. The body is made of a particular nature, but we are not alone with the body of a particular nature. Along with us is Krishna. And he is guiding the wanderings of all living beings. And then what should we do? Understanding that, so I am here, my body with my particular nature is here, but along with that, Krishna is also there here. Then 18.62 says, Tam eva sharanam gacha sarva bhavena bharata tat prasadat param shanti sthanam prapsasi shashvatam. Says, Tam eva sharanam gacha. Surrender to that Ishwara who is there in your heart. Sarva bhavena bharata. Wholeheartedly surrender to him. Tat prasadat, by his mercy, what will you obtain? Tat prasadat param shanti sthanam prapsasi shashvatam. You will get peace, the supreme peace, and you will get the enduring position or enduring sthanam, location. So for Arjuna there were two choices at the start of the war. Either he can, if he has peace, he will lose property, he will not get a kingdom. If he wants a kingdom, he cannot have peace. But Krishna is telling, if you surrender to me, if you surrender the Supreme Lord in the heart, by that surrender, you will both get the supreme peace because you will have harmonized with the divine and you will get the eternal destination. You will come to my abode. So both your fundamental needs, you're thinking this, by this I'll get this, by this I'll get this. No, by surrendering to Krishna, you will get both. So similarly, what Krishna is, if you consider this verses, how they apply to us. Now, if we simply act according to our nature alone and we don't care for Krishna. My nature is, okay, I am emotional. So whatever caters to my emotions, I'll do that. So that means, you know, if I watch some movies, I read some novels, I do this, and whatever caters to my emotions, whoever caters to my emotions, even that person be immoral, anti-devotional, is catering to my emotional needs. I'll take care of that. I'll do that. And what will happen? You will go into illusion. Krishna says, don't just act only according to your nature. But at the same time, he says, if you reject your nature, the nature is going to come back. And nature is going to force you to act in a particular. So, understand that we have our nature, but we also have Krishna. So, if we work only for our nature, we'll stay in illusion. We will go deeper into our illusion. If we work against our nature, it can't last for long. The needs will come back again and they'll force us. But if we work for Krishna with our nature, then we will have, for Arjuna, both the peace and the kingdom will be provided for. So Krishna says, similarly, if you work for Krishna with your nature, then both your material, the needs according to the material nature, whatever, they will be fulfilled. And the needs according to spiritual nature, that will also be fulfilled. So if somebody has a need for more bonding and emotional relationships, use that in Krishna's service. Get that fulfilled and fulfill that for others. So we'll get our emotional health restored and we'll also progress towards spiritual health. Because the practice of bhakti will provide us spiritual health. So we work not for our nature, not against our nature. We work for Krishna with our nature. And in this way, we pursue spiritual health while providing for our emotional health. And that way, we can be as peaceful as is practically possible while living in this world
and we pursue the path of ultimate happiness by developing our love for Krishna.
So I'll summarize. I spoke today about the second part of emotionally healthy spirituality, in which I focused how there anything that happens, there's an immediate cause, remote cause, and ultimate cause. So if I get malaria, it's because of mosquito bite, it's because of my past karma, it's because of my forgetfulness of Krishna. Now, we need to work both at the immediate level by taking the medicine and at the ultimate level by raising our consciousness to Krishna, by which you get out of the world. Now, if somebody pursues only the immediate solution, claiming that to be ultimate, then that is an illusion. Science alone or technological progress alone cannot free us from disease per se. 100 diseases may go, but may be eliminated, 100 new old diseases will come. So, on the other hand, if somebody pursues only the ultimate solution and neglects the immediate solution, that also is not going to work. Somebody surrenders to Jesus and says that you should not use specs now. You will not be able to see. You know, Arjuna demonstrates that he learned from Krishna the ultimate solution of working in Krishna consciousness, and he used from Drona the knowledge of Varachari that he had learned for serving Krishna in the Kurukshetra war. So we need to work both at the immediate and the ultimate level. So if we start attributing everything to past karma, then we will become very desensitive, we will become very insensitive, and all systems of relationships, justice, morality will collapse if we start attributing everything to remote causes. So if things are explainable or accountable at the immediate level, we address them at the immediate level. If my stomach is upset, what did I eat last night? But if I ate normal, still my stomach has got upset. That means something else is going on. So, we work at the immediate level when we can, but at the same time, we don't let working at the immediate level consume our whole attention. We work at the ultimate level also. So, working at the immediate level is like taking a pain-killing medicine. Working at the ultimate level is like taking the curative medicine. The painkiller should be the complement to the cure, not the substitute. And now just as different people can endure different levels of pain, they may require different doses of pain-killing medicine. Similarly, we all, based on our past karma, have certain levels of renunciation. And accordingly, we may need less or more material levels of comforts or necessities. Or we may have particular needs of the subtle body, emotionality, rationality, or whatever. So, whatever dosage of painkiller medicine we need, we take that and make sure that we continue with the treatment. So if I have certain emotional needs, I have certain rational needs, I have certain social needs, I make sure they are fulfilled and move towards Krishna. Sometimes the pain is caused by the stoppage of the painkilling medicine and we think the cure is not working. Like that, sometimes some of our emotional, social, rational needs are not taken care of. And because of that, we stop taking care of our spiritual needs and we give up the practice of bhakti. Rather than doing that, at an individual level, we should be ready that, okay, I should try to develop more and more renunciation. And even if my needs are not taken care of, other needs, still I practice Krishna Bhakti. Just like old people, they're told, just renounce the world and die alone. But at a community level, they're told, take care of the elderly. So the community should try to provide for all the needs of its members. And lastly, I concluded by talking about how, when we are practicing Krishna Bhakti, it is our responsibility to work with our material nature to realize our spiritual nature. Krishna tells Arjuna that don't work according to your nature alone, don't work against your nature. Work with your nature for Krishna. Then you will get both the kingdom and peace. Similarly, when we work addressing the needs of our nature towards Krishna, then both our emotional health will be taken care of and we will progress towards spiritual health also. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Are there any questions or comments? Yes, please go. Okay.
is astrology an immediate solution? Is the worship of the devatas also an immediate solution?
It's not exactly an immediate solution, it's more like an intermediate solution. Astrology, basically, it's not that the, sometimes you say, oh, you know, your Mangal is bad for you, or your Shani is bad, your Mars is bad for you, Saturn is bad for you. It's not that Mars and Saturn have particular agendas against some people. It's that actually all of us, by our own past karma, have done certain actions, and certain reactions are going to come. And the alignment of the planetary positions indicates what kind of reactions are going to come to us to some extent. Just like the position of the hands of a clock can roughly tell us, okay, how much illumination will be there outside. So similarly, the position of the planets can tell us roughly, okay, how much darkness or how much light is going to be there in our life at that particular time. So, at the level of astrology, we can come to know that, okay, you're going through some bad phase, so you can take some treatment for that, take some cure for that. So sometimes they may tell that, okay, this particular devata you can worship, this particular puja you can do. So now, astrology in principle has been a part of our tradition. At the same time, in practice, how it works, how much it works, it depends a lot on the expertise of the astrologer. And quite often, the astrologers may be too materially minded, too inexpert. And as devotees, if we get over-dependent on that, then sometimes we may use astrology to do what we want to do. That means, there's one devotee who has written a book, How to Mess Your Life with Astrology. So the idea is, if I want to break a particular relationship, then I go to astrologer. I say, no, just alright, this will be alright. Then no. I go to second astrologer. I go to third astrologer. I go to the 10th astrologer till I find somebody who says, just break this relationship. And then I say, oh, my astrologer told me, so I'm breaking this relationship. Or same way, I want to form a particular relationship, and I try to find an astrologer who says, yes, it's good for you. So basically, we may use astrology to do what we want to do. And then rather than the astrologer being a guide, the astrologer become like a justifier for us. So then it can become a big problem. So important thing for us is to, that in general, we focus on dealing with practical things practically, and we take shelter of Krishna. If somebody feels inspired to take guidance from astrology, take some input from astrology, it's good if there's an expert devotee astrologer who can give us devotional remedies. So if we are going through a bad phase, rather than worshipping a particular devata or a particular appeasing a particular planet, we can satisfy the manifestation of the Supreme who is presiding over that particular devata, that particular planet. So that way we can look for some devotional remedy. So whether to consult astrology or not, that's up to individual. Prabhupada sometimes would consult astrologer before he would travel, make his travel plan. So according to astrology, he said that on Thursday you should not travel. So Prabhupada would sometimes consult that. But if a program came up, he would travel on Thursday also. He was not dependent on that. So as Thursday, I'm just giving as an example. One particular, I'm not saying that. We are not making an absolute statement that nobody should travel on Thursday at all. Just giving an example of this. So the point is, astrology is something which has valid principles underlying it. But whether they can be applied today, whether there are experts who can actually guide us to apply them effectively today, that is something which is open to examination. Okay? Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Madhavi?
You mentioned that we have to take care of our immediate needs so that we can ultimately take care of the ultimate needs. But sometimes so much time goes for the immediate cause, that to reach the ultimate cause, we don't reach it.
Yeah, that's true.
Sometimes the immediate needs take so much time and energy that we can't do much to pursue the ultimate. Yes, that's why we have to make sure that there is some ground level commitment to the ultimate that we always keep. Without that, the immediate will consume everything. It's, sometimes we want to tie loose ends. Oh, let me fix this, let me fix this, let me fix this. But actually in material life, the loose ends never end. I fix 10 things, 11th, 12, 13, 14, they'll keep coming. That's why we have to have some rock bottom commitment. These are the things which I am going to do, no matter what happens. See, for important things, we don't, if something is important, sometimes we say, I don't know how I can find time for this. We say, fine, for important things, we don't have to find time. We have to allot time. When I say find time means, it's like, time is like some object that is lying in my suitcase and I have lost it somewhere. I am going with a flashlight to locate where is the time. It's not like that. We all have the same amount of time. And for important things, we have to allot time. So, now, having said that, we need to allot time for some ground level commitment to the ultimate solution, to the practice of bhakti. Along with that, there are phases in our life when the immediate may require more time than usual. And that's just the way life is. That's okay. Sometimes health may be bad, the financial situation, ups and downs may be there. Sometimes in our social relational situation, some turbulence might be there. So, if that requires in some situations more time, that's fine. It's like, I give the example that if you're traveling along a road, the traffic becomes crowded, you slow down at that time because you can't move fast. Traffic becomes clear, we move faster afterwards. So, we keep moving forwards. Just because the traffic is so, we don't stop and turn around and go in the other direction. Keep moving. So, like that, we keep trying to move towards Krishna with whatever capacity we have and in our particular situation. And eventually things become more clear and we move faster. And one more aspect of Krishna Bhakti is that immediate solutions can be done with the consciousness of the ultimate. Now I may work at a practice, I may be earning money, I'm taking care of my family. So we can see these are all bodily needs which I'm taking care of. But I can do them in a mood of service to Krishna. So that is not the only service you're meant to perform. We're meant to perform direct devotional service also. But we don't have to necessarily divorce the two completely. If I infuse the mood of service into whatever I'm doing, then we move towards Krishna. You know, Prabhupada would tell that, you know, at one time there were some, in the early days, then all the devotees were living in the temple itself. So some of the temple leaders also were not so mature. They told devotee mothers who had young small children, saying, yes, we have one mother, you can take care of all the children and all of you go for book distribution. And the babies did not have enough time with their mothers. When Prabhupada came to know about this, Prabhupada said, I'm surprised. But you are leaving your child to the care of someone else. Prabhupada said, your children are like your deities. Take care of them first and then you do other services. So, Prabhupada did not see that this is just your child and you take care of children. This child has special souls who are sent to us by Krishna. They're Vaikuntha children, Prabhupada would say. So we can infuse whatever we are doing at the immediate level with the consciousness of the ultimate, with the mood of service to the ultimate. So that way we can work through our situation towards Krishna, whatever that situation is. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Hare Krishna. Any other questions? Yes, Prabhu.
Thank you, Prabhu. Look at the earlier part. So, when you're trying to guard your emotional well-being, or when you're trying to secure your trust there, it is sometimes, at least in my case, it is this guilt of selfishness that, oh, I'm being harsh with this person, or I'm being creating a difference for this person because I see that their nature is not conducive and it pulls me down. How do you deal with this internal confusion, whether it is in the community or in the family level, where taking a set of action to another person, where a strong solution that you're trying to provide, creates that internal guilt when you're trying to provide?
So if we are in a situation in a particular relationship in a family or community where we're just not able to get along with someone, but we are told just tolerate and get along, but that causes too much agitation for us. So should we just accept it? But if we try to change it, then are we working at a right way to do it? The key thing is that we need to keep moving towards Krishna. And say, suppose, a simple example earlier. Suppose if I am sitting and chanting in a group of devotees, I sit next to a devotee and I find that devotee chanting very loudly. I can't hear my holy name. Then I move a little further away. Then I find that devotee also chanting loudly. Then I move a little further away. And then if all my 2 hours are just moving from one place to another, to another, to another, to another, and then I move outside and I say, the vehicles are too loud over here. Then I go to my house and they say somebody is playing a TV over there. Then I keep shifting my situation horizontally here, there, here, there, here, there. And I don't chant at all. No, I have to say, okay, this is the situation I am in. I have to chant. I can try to minimize the distraction as much as possible. But I cannot let my whole energy go simply in minimizing the distraction. So we have to use our intelligence at some level, how much to address the situation at a practical level and how much to tolerate and just move on towards the ultimate. So similar, it's the same way, just as we have physically move a little bit and decide that's enough now, let me just focus on hearing the situation. Like that, we also have to decide, okay, with this person I'm working, I cannot work too closely with that person. But sometimes, we get so, just as attachment can be a distraction in bhakti, similarly aversion can be a distraction in bhakti also. Sometimes we are too attached to someone. When we come to a temple, we are not really coming to the temple to see Krishna. We are coming to see someone who we are attached to. And then we are not really focusing on Krishna at that time. I'm talking about here materially attached, not spiritually attached. But sometimes we become so averse that, say, if that person is going to come to temple, I will not come to the temple. Well, that means, I am considering my relationship with that person as more defining than my relationship with Krishna. We cannot go into that zone of aversion also. So, we don't have to go out of our way to interact with someone whose nature doesn't work with us. And we don't have to go out of our way, or we don't have to make it our life's mission to avoid that person. We just find our service and we move on in our service. And if something is not working, we create some distance. So rather than seeing that only the immediate or only the ultimate, or how much immediate or how much ultimate, we just focus on what is practical. It's sometimes we can adjust a little bit something at the immediate level so that we can focus more on the ultimate level. But sometimes it may be that the difficulty in getting a immediate solution may be what may force us to seek the ultimate solution more diligently. Sometimes when we just realize, I can't do anything about this. Sometimes I do something small and then I can focus more on Krishna. Sometimes I just can't do anything and that's when I focus on Krishna most. Krishna, I need you. So we have to see what works best so that we can connect with Krishna. So they keep the ultimate purpose of connecting our consciousness with Krishna in mind, then how to balance between the immediate and ultimate, that will work out. Okay? Thank you. Yes, we had a question here. Okay. Any Mataji? Yeah, okay. Mataji, any other Mataji have any question? Yes, Mataji. We'll come back to you. Yeah. ओके श्री गौनताय भगवान की राधा वल्लभ भगवान की जगन्नाथ बलदेव सुभद्रा मैया की सो इफ 300 पीपल आर ऑन अ फ्लाइट and if that flight crashes, then is it that all of them have the same karma because of which they are killed? At that time, the karma is a very subtle concept, gahana karmanugati. Sometimes we may try to, we say, okay, this action has that reaction, and that action has that reaction. So does that mean all those 300 people have done the exact same bad karma, same one action because of which they are all dying over here? Not like that. Karma is the system of correlation between action and reaction. But it is not that simple. Sometimes one action may lead to a series of reactions. Sometimes one action, that means say, if somebody drives drunk, they may damage their car, they may injure someone, they may get a legal fine, they may... somebody whom they have injured, that person becomes vengeful and decides to attack and kill them. So a series of reactions may come. I'm just giving from a practical perspective of how one action can lead to many reactions. So conversely, many actions, their reaction may be concentrated in one event that happens in our life. So for example, say somebody is somebody is born poor. Now we could say that's a lifelong reaction that is coming. Now that poverty may trouble them constantly in some ways, but sometimes it may trouble them acutely and sometimes it may not trouble them so much. So the point which I am making over here is that when certain things happen to someone, it is not that they necessarily... So if I slip and fall on the water, does that mean necessarily that, you know, I had spilled water in somebody's path and I made them fall and that's why I'm falling right now? It may be, it may not be. Sometimes we talk about karma in those terms. If you kill an animal, you will be killed. That's true, but that is indicative. That is not necessarily the only way karma will work. So, if we, although karma is a subtle and not so easily quantifiable concept, but what we can understand is that say, if say this much quantity of karma is, when that much quantity of karma is supposed to be delivered, then that person's life ends. Now how this particular quantum of karma will be accumulated by that person will vary from how another person accumulated that quantity of karma. So if there are 300 people in a flight and they all die, that means they all had accumulated the quantum of karma which was what was needed for them to die at that time. But that does not mean exactly all of them had done the same actions. They all could have done different actions at different times and they all get different reactions. They all have different specific reactions to their particular karmas. But those reactions combine together to give a particular physical form to the reaction. Even when death occurs, for some people, even if the flight gets destroyed, now some people may just be sleeping and they die in their sleep. They don't feel much pain at that time. Somebody is awake and they see their body burning, they are horrified and then they die. Or sometimes 10 people go through the same emotional trauma. But some people get very traumatized, some people are not barely scarred by that. So we see that karmic reaction, how it comes and how it affects, all that, there are many subtleties in it. So there is mass karma where many people may get their reactions together at one time. But still the actions that they have done can be individual and different. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Yes, please. So how do we find out what is our real nature? And where there's social pressure, there is devotee pressure. Yes. Most importantly, there is the mental pressure. If you ask the mind, what is my nature? Whatever you are doing right now, that is not your nature. The nature of the mind is that it will keep us dissatisfied. Whatever we do. Even if we go to paradise, the mind will say, yes, but... So, we cannot simply bank on the emotions of our mind to decide what is our nature. So in general, when we are going through our life, we try to cultivate an attitude of service, an attitude of surrender. Okay, whatever situation I am in, I'll try to serve in the best way that I can. Whatever service I am given, I'll try to do it to the best of my capacity. But while cultivating this mood of surrender and service, we observe ourselves. And we may find, okay, this service I like to do. And this service I'm good at doing. So these two things, guna, karma. Guna means internal comfort in doing something. Karma means external competence in doing that thing. So gradually as we find out there are certain things you are comfortable doing internally and you are competent doing externally, then we can understand this is more or less what I am naturally inclined to do. And we can try to gradually increase that more and more. So rather than thinking that it's like discovering my nature or finding my nature is like finding one key in a treasure hunt which will open the whole treasure for me. You can see it's a gradual discovery. So we have the attitude of service, we do whatever we are told to do. By that we learn to discipline our mind. But we also observe what I am competent, what I am comfortable with, and do that more and more. That when we slowly start aligning with our nature. Yes. Yeah.
You can do seminars yesterday, one today. I think the position was two key actions that you can do.
Okay. So can I suggest some two, three actions that we can do to apply whatever we talk about in these seminars? First would be that if we feel dissatisfied, troubled, irritated, then don't think that that is a lack of Krishna bhakti. Try to find out what is the circumstantial situation because of which. So if I'm not getting taste in chanting, it may not just be because the holy name is, I'm not able to connect with the holy name. It may be because there are other things which are affecting me. So we try to not attribute our dissatisfaction to the lack of potency of Krishna bhakti, but we try to explore and see if I have particular needs, say if I find out what is it doing which makes me feel satisfied, or what is it not doing which or not getting which makes me very agitated. So if I come to someone and I greet them and they don't greet me, I get very agitated by that. Or if I come in and I see that this thing is not done right, I feel very angry. So basically, doing what makes us feel very satisfied, doing or not doing what causes us very great agitation. We can observe that. And that can give us some more inkling towards our own nature, towards what our needs are, towards what our strengths are. And lastly, we can try to become more observant of others and more understanding rather than more negligent or judgmental. Now, some devotees get very disturbed by something. Rather, why do you make such a big hue and cry over such a small thing? Okay, try to understand, okay, that means this is not a small thing for them. So that doesn't mean we have to overvalue every single thing. But rather than seeing neglecting others or judging others, we can try to see their actions as ways of better understanding them. And then depending on our particular relationship with them, depending on what facility we have, we can try to address those needs for them, and that way we can serve them. We are serving them is not just by encouraging them to chant Hare Krishna or engaging them in direct devotional activities. Serving others can also be facilitating their emotional, social, rational situation so that they can serve Krishna better. So that way, both in self-understanding and in understanding others, we can try to apply what we discussed. Okay? So, thank you very much for your kind attention and for your enthusiastic participation. I've been here for the third time now, and every time your enthusiasm continues to astonish me. Today I was talking with His Grace Aniruddha Prabhu, and I told him that the combination that in various parts of the world I have traveled, the combination of a significantly large congregation with a serious ethos of education, where devotees are eager to hear and understand deeper aspects of philosophy, that is present in barely a handful of places in all over the world, ISKCON. So all of you are jewels in the crown on Srila Prabhupada's head. And if I have committed any offenses, I seek your forgiveness and I seek your prayers and blessings so that I can continue my service to Krishna, and my best wishes to all of you. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki.
I saw your email.
This one, right?